Welcome to Historians on the Record, brought to you by the Gilder-Lehrman Institute of American History. I'm Jim Basker, president of the Institute. Our mission is to promote the study and love of American history through programs such as these. Please visit us on the web at www.gilderlehrman.org to sign up for our mailing list and learn more about our resources for teachers and students.
Thank you. It is indeed a great pleasure to talk with you tonight about this man that I actually lived with for 10 years, the last 10 years of my life. And I must say it was pretty frightening 10 years ago when I decided to spend all that time with him, mainly because, of course, so many books have been written about him, more than any other person other than Jesus Christ. So I had to figure out what angle I could possibly bring to it that wouldn't simply be repetitive. And the other problem was that he was older than any of the other subjects I had studied, deader than any of the other subjects I had written about, which meant that unlike the Kennedys, which was one of my books, or Lyndon Johnson, or the Roosevelts, where I could even at the Roosevelt time, Eleanor and Franklin, there were dozens of people alive who had known them, so I could interview them, and I could really be able to test my own assumptions by people who'd actually known them or worked in the White House. And then, of course, with Lyndon Johnson, I'd had the extraordinary privilege of having worked for him when I was only 24 years old. It was a peculiar relationship that we had. It started when I was selected as a White House Fellow, a terrific program. Colin Powell was a White House Fellow, Wesley Clark, senators. There was a big dance at the White House the night we were selected. President Johnson did dance with me, not that peculiar. There were only three women out of the 16 White House Fellows. And he did say he wanted me to work directly for him in the White House, but it was not to be that simple. For in the months leading up to my selection, like many other young people, I'd been active in the anti-Vietnam War movement and had written an article against him, which unfortunately came out in the New Republic days after this big dance in the White House. And the theme of the article was how to remove Lyndon Johnson from power. So I was certain that he would kick me out of the program, but instead, surprisingly, he said, oh, bring her down here for a year, and if I can't win her over, no one can. So I did end up working for him that last year in the White House, and then, as was said, accompanying him to his ranch to help him on his memoirs, never fully understanding why he had chosen me to spend so many hours with. I like to believe it was because I was a good listener, and he was a great storyteller, fabulous, colorful, anecdotal stories. There was a problem with these stories I later discovered, which is that half of them weren't true, but they were great nonetheless. So I think part of his attraction for me was that I loved listening to his tall tales, but I was also worried that part of the attraction was that I was then a young woman, and he had somewhat of a minor league Bill Clinton reputation for womanizing. So I was constantly chattering to him about boyfriends, even when I didn't have them, everything working perfectly until one day he said he wanted to discuss our relationship, which sounded very ominous, especially when he took me nearby to the lake, conveniently called Lake Lyndon Baines Johnson. And there was wine and cheese and a red check tablecloth, all the romantic trappings. And he started out, Doris, more than any other woman I have ever known, and my heart sank. And then he said, you remind me of my mother. It was pretty embarrassing, given what was going on in my mind. So anyways, when I finally went back to old Abe Lincoln, I knew there'd be no picnics by the lake with Abe Lincoln. There'd be nobody I could talk to who would have known him. But I found something even more valuable than that personal contact, and that is that, of course, the people in his generation kept diaries and wrote letters. And I think for an historian, there's nothing more extraordinary than to be able to feel like you're looking over the shoulder of a diary entry or a handwritten letter that was written at the end of the day and feel the emotions that the letter itself projects. Indeed, in the archives of Seward family, Seward who becomes Lincoln's Secretary of State, there were 5,000 letters written during the Civil War. He had a daughter named Fanny who, when she was 16 years old, wanted to be a writer so badly that she vowed she would never marry, not thinking she could combine married life and career. She kept a diary all through the Civil War. It turned out 900 pages, and she kept it till she turned 21. The war came to an end, and she died of tuberculosis. His Secretary of the Treasury, Chase, kept a diary for 4 decades, as did Bates, his Attorney General. And through these sources, I came to feel a Lincoln that was different from the one that I had known before. I knew when I started this that I respected him and that he was a great statesman, but what I could see through all of these primary sources was that the image that we've had of him over the years as a melancholy man had been overdone. True, he had had a melancholy temperament, I suspect. He had had one depressive episode, which I'll talk about later. But during the war, what became clear through these diaries and these letters written daily was that he was the one who sustained everyone else's spirits. An extraordinary sense of humor, wonderful gift for storyteller, and a wonderful understanding of his own mood so that he knew how to shake his own anxieties away. And then when I realized that these characters who wrote these diaries and kept these letters had actually been his chief rivals for the Republican nomination in 1860, then finally I knew the story that I wanted to tell. The story of the most unusual cabinet in presidential history. For not only were these men his chief rivals for the nomination, but they also had been much better known than he, much more celebrated, more experienced, and it meant that when he put them in his cabinet, people worried that he would become a figurehead, but somehow he knew that he needed these strong men by his side. And so that ended up being the story I wanted to tell of how he created this team that would take him to win the war, save the Union, and end slavery forever. I came away eventually looking backward in time. I thought I might start right then with the Republican nomination in 1860, but in order to understand the springs of character of these other guys in his cabinet, I realized I had to go backward in time and see where they had come from as well, and to take Lincoln back in time too. And the comparative analysis, I'd like to believe, really helped me to see Lincoln in new lights, because I could put them always with him as they were growing older and see what disadvantages he had to get through compared to his far more privileged rivals. And it turned out that I looked back at Lincoln's upbringing to realize that the qualities that we saw later in him really were in some ways visible, even in that frontier environment. Though he was burning with a desire to learn from the time he was young, it was almost impossible for him to go to school. In those days, there were few schools in the area where he was, but more importantly than that, his father needed him to work on the hardscrabble farm and would then loan him away to other farmers so that he could pay off debts. So Lincoln was only able to attend school a few weeks here, a few weeks there. He later calculated that he had only gone to formal schooling 1 year total altogether, and yet he scoured the countryside for books and read everything he could lay his hands on. It was said when he got a copy of the King James Bible or Aesop's Fables or one of Shakespeare's plays that he was so excited he couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep. The great poet Emily Dickinson once said, "There is no frigate like a book to take us lands away." How true for Lincoln. Though he never would travel to Europe, he went with Shakespeare's kings to Merry England. He went with Lord Byron's poetry to Spain and Portugal. Literature allowed him to transcend his surroundings. But there were so many losses in his early life that he was haunted by death. His mother died when he was 9 years old. His only sister, Sarah, died of childbirth a few years later. And his first love, Anne Rutledge, died at the age of 22. Moreover, when his mother lay dying, she didn't hold out for him that hope that would be so prevalent at that time. Death stalked these people in the 19th century so much so that the deathbed scenes that one reads about in history, people would routinely talk about siblings that had gone before that one would meet in the other world. But in Lincoln's case, when his mother lay dying, she simply said to him, "Abraham, I'm going away from you now, and I shall never return." As a result, he became haunted by the thought that when one dies, dust becomes dust, that your earthly existence comes to an end. As he grew, he seemed to adopt slowly a solace from what resembles an ancient Greek notion that there was one way that your earthly existence could continue, and that would be if you could accomplish something worthy in life, so worthy that your story could be told after you die, which meant that he had this huge ambition from the time he was young, not simply for celebrity or power or office, but rather, as he himself articulated it, the desire somehow to leave the world a little better place for his having lived in it. I came away believing that that ambition became, in a certain sense, his lodestar. It carried him through all those tough early years when he had to work as a postmaster and a surveyor and a clerk while studying law on his own at night. It carried him through the one significant depression he did have when he was in his early 30s, when three things had combined to lay him low. He had broken his engagement with Mary Todd, not certain he was ready to be married, but knowing how much it hurt her by his doing so. And his one intimate friend, Joshua Speed, was leaving Illinois to go back to Kentucky because his father had died, and this was the only friend he had really been able to pour his heart out to. And his political career in the state legislature, where he'd been elected 4 times, was coming to an end, and his popularity was depleting because he had sponsored a series of public works projects in Illinois. The state went into a recession, went into bankruptcy, and these expensive projects that he had sponsored were considered part of the cause. So he lost his own popularity. He was so sad, took to his bed, that his friends worried that he was suicidal. They went to his room. They took all knives and razors and scissors from his room. And Joshua Speed went to his side and said, "Lincoln, you must rally or you will die." He said then, "I would just as soon die now, but I have not yet done anything to make any human being remember that I have lived." And then he confided in Speed that dream of his to somehow accomplish something worthy enough so that his story could be told. So fueled by that ambition, he got out of that depression, back into the state legislature, and then a few years later ran for a seat in Congress, where he promptly lost popularity there because his maiden speech questioned the rationale for the Mexican-American War. It's amazing when you read the words that he used at that time, arguing that the president's rationale for the war was sheer deception from beginning to end, arguing that you cannot allow a president to invade any other country at will. However, the war then was so popular that he was considered a Benedict Arnold for having questioned the president, and he could not really run for Congress again because he lost his own popularity. He kept arguing, "I have voted for supplies at every step along the way," which is echoing exactly what's going on in American debate right now. But rather than letting that undo his ambitions for the future, he decided to try a few years later for the next higher rung, to run for the United States Senate. He ran twice. He lost twice. Someone else might have said, "Lincoln, it's time for another profession. You're not doing too well." But he always had this ability to motivate himself in the face of frustration, and he figured out what had gone wrong and decided he could still go forward, and he decided to run as a dark horse candidate for the presidency on the Republican ticket in 1860. Everyone expected Seward, the governor and senator from New York, to be the victor. He had been the most celebrated anti-slavery orator of the decade. His name was on everybody's lips, one of the founders of the Republican Party. And if not Seward, they thought it would be Salmon Chase, who had been the governor and senator from Ohio. And if not Chase, Edward Bates, an elder statesman from Missouri. But as the convention was beginning to wind up in that spring of 1860, it turned out in retrospect that Lincoln had, if not the resume, since he had the thinnest resume of them all, he had a set of emotional qualities and political skills that far outrivaled his rivals, and he ended up with this surprise nomination. I think for one thing, he was determined from the start not to disparage any of his 3 rivals. While they were busy attacking one another, he kept aloof from that battle. And he worked harder than any of the other 3 combined. Seward was so sure that he was going to be the nominee that he came over to Europe for 9 months prior to the convention. He was dined by kings and queens who thought they were meeting the next president of the United States. And meanwhile, Chase was offered to give a speech at Cooper Union, where Lincoln eventually made one of the speeches that created his fame, and he decided he didn't really want to leave Ohio to go to New York. Bates never wanted to leave Missouri, his home state. Meanwhile, Lincoln went from one state to the other, developing a following because his speeches had a power that was unlike that of the other 3. Unlike his rivals, and indeed unlike most of the anti-slavery orators in the 1850s, when slavery was such a passionate issue, it would be common for those orators to argue that Southerners were evil, unchristian men. Lincoln, however, always had this extraordinary empathy to try and see people from all different sides of an issue. So he argued that the Southerners are we in the North, what we would be in their situation. If the South no longer had slavery, they would not introduce it. If we in the North still had slavery, we would not know how to get rid of it instantly. I cannot blame them for not doing what I myself would not know how to do. And then he was able to argue against the spread of slavery to the Western territories, which was the one thing that Congress did have power over. And because of the beauty of the language of his speeches, the authenticity of his voice, as I say, he began to develop followings that began to grow larger and larger. And more importantly, perhaps, throughout his career, Lincoln had not made any lasting enemies. He had somehow had this capacity, when he lost these previous elections, to turn his opponents into friendships, knowing that politics is a continuing game of human relationships, and your enemies one day may be your allies the next day, whereas each one of the other three rivals had made permanent enemies that then showed up at the convention ready to hurt them if they could. And Lincoln understood the best strategy from the start at the convention. He wrote to the delegates saying, "I know I'm not your first love, but if you can't have your first love, come to me as your second love," in other words, a very humble thing to do. So what happened is, when the delegates did not manage to give a majority to Seward, he just fell short on that first ballot, and they were all wondering, what are we going to do next? Where do we go? Lincoln was the only one who had not hurt their man. So they turned to Lincoln, and by the third ballot, he won that surprising victory. And then when the Democratic Party split in two in 1860, he won the election itself. It was a stunning thing for the country at large, so much so that people didn't even know for sure what his name was. In some of the newspapers, it was considered Abram instead of Abraham, and he had to write to the journalist saying, "My name is actually Abraham Lincoln." And the morning after his victory, he made the decision that would define his presidency, which was to put these three rivals into his cabinet. His friends came to him and said, "You can't do that. They'll so overshadow you that it will undo your presidency." A less confident man probably wouldn't have done that, but he had this internal confidence that allowed him to know, as he said, "Look, these are the strongest and most able men in the country. The country is in peril. I need these men by my side." But perhaps my old friend Lyndon Johnson might have put it somewhat more crudely: better to have your enemies inside the tent pissing out than outside the tent pissing in right at you. Old Lyndon knew how to do these things. Now, to be sure, Seward, Chase, and Bates were all able and strong men, but in the end, it was this prairie lawyer from Illinois who proved to be the master of them all, as the arc of his relationship with each one of these men would show. I think winning over Seward was the most remarkable trait. Seward had not only been so sure that he would win, but so were all of his followers, so much so that 10,000 people had gathered outside his home in Auburn, New York, ready to celebrate. The champagne was already uncorked. When he lost that nomination, he said when he walked around the street the next day, he felt like he was hearing his own obituary. When Lincoln asked him to be Secretary of State, the most powerful position in the cabinet at that time, he agreed, thinking, "All right, I'll be the prime minister. Lincoln will be really a subordinate to me. He'll be a figurehead." But he soon found out that that was not to be the case. He wrote, in the first months of the administration, he acted in a very presumptuous manner and wrote a very now famous memo to Lincoln in which he said, "The administration seems to be drifting." This was before Fort Sumter. "The administration seems to be drifting without a policy. Something has to be done. Somebody has to do it. If you need someone to take charge," essentially he was saying, "here I am. I will do it." Lincoln at that moment could have caused his resignation, could have at least confronted him directly, but he knew where Seward was coming from. He left unsaid what he might have been feeling, and instead, very clearly, however, said, "The policy is not one that's drifting. You've agreed with it at every step in our cabinet meetings, which happened twice a week at that time. And besides, if any change has to be made, I am the president, and I will make it." Seward realized he'd been put in his place, and within weeks, he came to write a letter to his wife saying, "Lincoln is an unusual man. He's unlike anyone that I've ever met before." He settled down to give up his own ambitions to run against Lincoln in 1864, because all of his followers thought, "Just give him one term, you'll come back, you'll return." He decided to simply become Lincoln's ally, his partner, and indeed his most intimate friend during this darkest time of the Civil War. In many ways, Seward reminded me of Winston Churchill. He smoked cigars all day long, he drank all night long, and yet he came back to work the next morning with great verve and vigor. Great, affable, outgoing personality, loved to tell stories, in many ways shared those qualities with Lincoln. Lincoln loved nothing more at night than to go to Seward's mansion across from the White House in Lafayette Park, and the two would sit there with Lincoln's leg up on a chair, and they'd talk of everything else beside the war. They could relax together in a way that Lincoln couldn't easily relax with anyone else. So that became a friendship, I think, that Lincoln was able to shape, able to mold, and it became critical for both men. Now, Chase, who becomes his Secretary of the Treasury, had almost the opposite personality to Seward's. As opposed to Seward's warmth and his love of novels and his love of theater, which Lincoln shared, Chase thought theater was sinful. He thought novels were a waste of time. He was very deeply religious, would spend his evenings reading in his Bible, practicing jokes, the end punchline of which he could never remember. And he would write in his diary from the time he was 18 of his desire to be first wherever he was. He had a relentless drive to be president of the United States. It was sad in many ways because he accomplished so much in his life. When he was a young lawyer, he was considered the attorney general for runaway slaves because he defended so many of them. He became the senator and governor of Ohio, a great secretary of the treasury, and yet he chased that presidency almost like a will-o'-the-wisp, feeling that his life would not be fulfilled without the presidency. I think in some ways that relentless drive came from a terrible void in his own private life. He had married three times, and each one of his three wives had died very young. His first wife died in childbirth at the age of 22, his second wife of tuberculosis at 25, and his third wife of tuberculosis in her early 30s, and he never did marry again, pouring all of his ambitions, his hopes, and his dreams into his political career, which meant that even as Secretary of Treasury under Lincoln, he still wanted to be president and tried to run against him in 1864 while remaining in the cabinet. He was using the Treasury Department as a machine to try and build up supporters, saying all sorts of disparaging things about Lincoln, letting his home be a place where parties took place, where his supporters would gather, criticizing Lincoln. Lincoln knew everything that Chase was doing. One of the things that Lincoln was great at was gossip, and interestingly, it's an important thing for a leader to know the currents of what's going on around him. So he would often invite young newspaper guys to the White House at night so they could tell him what was happening, young congressmen. And when his friends would say, "Don't you know that Chase is saying these things about you?" he said, "I know everything Chase is doing. But so long as he remains a great Secretary of the Treasury, so long as he provides the funds for the Union Army, that's far more important than whatever he's saying about me." And besides, he thought, Chase is so awkward as a politician, he will eventually mess up, which is exactly what happened. It was one thing for him to say orally things against Lincoln, but at a certain point, a pamphlet was published, a written pamphlet with all sorts of mean remarks about Lincoln in it, traced back to Chase, and other Republicans were furious at the idea that this intra-party squabble had become public. Chase had to withdraw from the presidential race embarrassingly, and of course, Lincoln won that second time around in November of 1864. But then, amazingly, a vacancy arose in the vaulted position of Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, and Lincoln decides to appoint Chase to that position. And again, his friends come to him and said, "Lincoln, how can you do that? Don't you know the horrible things he's been saying about you?" And Lincoln said, "I know worse things that Chase has said about me than any of you do. In fact, on a personal level, I would rather swallow a chair than appoint Chase to this position, but he will be the best man for the rights of the emancipated slaves because of his honored past, and that's more important than my personal feelings toward him." Again, that quality of leadership to be able to put the purpose and the larger goal ahead of the petty grievance that one might feel, and Chase did indeed perform honorably in that position. Now, Bates, who becomes his attorney general, the arc of his life was almost the opposite to Chase's because he had once been as ambitious as Chase. He was a young member of the Missouri State Constitution that created the convention that created that state, a young legislator sent to the state legislature, a young congressman. But then he fell so deeply in love with his wife, Julia, that he couldn't bear being away from her. Sometimes I think historians miss looking at the private lives of these figures to the extent to which they really affect their public ambitions. And in this case, as he was on his way to Congress, he wrote these long letters to his wife, and you'd be gone for 6 months at a time in those days, given transportation, saying, "I don't know why I'm going to Congress. I have this restless, indefinable feeling whenever I'm away from you. I can get through the days okay, but the nights are terrible. I never want to feel it again." So eventually he didn't stand for Congress again. He was actually offered several high cabinet posts before Lincoln, which he turned down. He just wanted to be in the nights with his wife, Julia. Well, it turned out he must have been with her a few of these nights since they ended up having 17 children. So they managed somehow to get together during this period of time. Now, he agrees to run for the presidency in 1860 only because his supporters thought maybe, just maybe, he could hold the North and the South together. He had originally come from Virginia, where he owned slaves. He He was now in, and he had freed his slaves. He was now in a border state, so maybe the North and the South would see him as a compromise candidate. When Lincoln won, he at first thought Lincoln was a good man, but nothing exceptional. But then as he watched the maneuverings by which Lincoln was able to deal with these fiery people within his cabinet, not only were they Lincoln's rivals, but they were rivals to one another. They had been former Democrats, former Whigs, former abolitionists, former nativists. Some of them hated one another so much they wouldn't even speak to each other, and yet Lincoln somehow forged them together in team. And when Bates saw that, he ended up saying at the end of Lincoln's time that in office that Lincoln was as near a perfect man as anyone he had ever met. But perhaps the most remarkable transformation in attitudes toward Lincoln showing his leadership skills came from Stanton, who became his Secretary of War. Stanton and Lincoln had met when they were young lawyers in the 1850s. Stanton was a nationally known, celebrated lawyer. Lincoln was known only in Illinois. Stanton had a very lucrative potential patent case that was going to be tried in Illinois, so he and his partner thought, well, we may need someone of counsel in Illinois. Someone went and interviewed Lincoln, thought he'd be good for the case. But then it turned out at the last minute the case was transferred from Illinois back to Ohio, where Stanton came from, so they didn't need Lincoln anymore, but they forgot to tell him. So he kept working all summer on his brief. He was so excited with the thought of working with Stanton. He went to Cincinnati, Ohio on his own, went right up to Stanton in his typically affable way and said, "Let's go up to the courthouse together." It was recorded at the time that Stanton took one look at Lincoln, who had a huge stain on his shirt, his hair was disheveled, his trousers were too short for his long legs, and he turned to his partner and he said, "We've got to get rid of this long-armed ape. He will hurt our case." They turned their back on him. They never opened the brief he had so painstakingly prepared. At the boarding house at night, they didn't invite him to sit at their table. When Lincoln left Cincinnati at the end of the week, he said he was so humiliated he never even wanted to go back to that city again. And yet 6 years later, in 1861, when Lincoln's first Secretary of War, Cameron, has resigned, everybody comes to him and said, "Lincoln, Stanton is the man you need. The War Department had to be revolutionized. There had only been 50,000 soldiers prior to the Civil War, and they had to, in the North, they had to get millions together in order to prosecute the war, and they needed to get the supplies and everything going." They said, "Stanton is the kind of man, he's tough, he's brilliant, he's mean to subordinates at times, but he's the one that will shake that War Department up." And somehow Lincoln was able to put that normal human desire, I suspect, to get back at someone who's hurt you, put that aside, forget the past grudge, and give Stanton this extraordinarily powerful post. And in the end, the two men became so close, an odd couple as they were, because Stanton was always so intense and Lincoln was so compassionate. They would argue continually about pardons for soldiers whenever a mother would come in wanting a pardon for her soldier who was about to be executed for having run away from battle or fallen asleep on checkpoint duty. Lincoln would pardon him, much to the dismay of Stanton, who felt the discipline of the army was at stake. But they finally worked out a working relationship where each could veto the other 50% of the time. And in the end, Stanton came away feeling that he loved Lincoln more than anyone outside of his family. So what were the leadership qualities that allowed Lincoln to master all of these remarkable men? All of these men, when I look at our current political scene today, are probably larger than anyone in our scene today, just showing how large I believe Lincoln was. First and foremost, I would believe it is that quiet self-confidence that allowed him to put them into the place in the first place. And the patience that allowed them to argue with him their points of view. He would listen to them for hours on end, but then once he made a decision, he made it clear, the decision is made, no more debate is going to happen, I'll listen to you on the margins, but this is what we are going to do. And he also allowed them to argue with one another fiercely within his official family, but then after a while told them, "I don't want to hear these arguments outside this official family." Secondly, I think it would be this inborn quality that he had, which was a most unusual empathy. Not only could he understand what people on the other side were thinking, it was almost like he could feel what other people were feeling. I remember Isaiah Berlin once said about Franklin Roosevelt that he thought that Franklin Roosevelt, too, registered within himself this seismological understanding of the feelings and the currents in the country as a whole. Well, Lincoln had that as well. And it meant that when he put this team together, he understood their need for approval and self-respect, which meant that when something went good in the administration, something went well, he would immediately send off a note of appreciation, sharing credit for success. Harry Truman once said, there's nothing you can accomplish, everything you can do, you can accomplish in life, so long as you're willing to not say that you deserve the credit alone, so long as you're willing to share that credit. How true for Lincoln. He understood that instinctively. There's a wonderful moment when Grant was made head of the Union Army, and he came to a reception in Washington in the spring of 1864, and he was so popular that everyone was crowding around him, leaving Lincoln almost standing alone. And Lincoln was approached by someone saying, "How does it feel to cede the place of honor in your own White House?" But the answer was so typically Lincolnian: the path to success and ambition is broad enough for two people to walk it abreast. But even more telling than his ability to share credit for success was his willingness to take responsibility for failure of his subordinates. Over and over again, when something went wrong, he stood up and took that responsibility. The most dramatic moment of that is when Cameron, his first Secretary of War, was censured by the Congress for having let contracts to middlemen in the early days of the war, and the middlemen made off with scandalous profits for weapons that didn't work, for guns that didn't shoot, horses that were blind. He felt not only that his political career was coming to an end because he was resigning from the cabinet, but that it was a stigma on his family for generations. At that low moment in his life, Lincoln stood up for him. He wrote a letter to the Congress in which he said, "If anyone is to blame for these unfortunate contracts, it is me and my entire cabinet." And then he explained the chaos of the early days of the war when they had nothing to supply the soldiers with, and mistakes were made. Cameron later said no one else would have been there for him in that tough moment. But Lincoln, he finally concluded, which Seward had concluded months earlier, was unlike anyone he had ever known. Now, that ability to concede errors on his own part was important because it meant that he could learn from his mistakes. There's a great quote that's attributed to him. When he had to change his mind on something where he might have been wrong the first time around, he simply would say, "I'd like to believe I'm smarter today than I was yesterday." When I think about all the machinations going on in American politics right now about acknowledging error, President Bush seeming to have a great trouble with acknowledging error, and even now Hillary Clinton being pilloried for not being willing to say that the war was a mistake, it seems like Lincoln had such an easier time by dealing with it straight on. "Yes, I've changed my mind on a particular issue. I've gotten smarter. I'd like to believe I'm smarter today than I was yesterday." And he also knew his own weaknesses well enough that he could compensate for them. One of his weaknesses was to give everybody a second and a third chance. And this worked disastrously with General McClellan, the leader of the Union Army for those first couple years. McClellan was perfect in the first phase of what he asked him to do, which was to organize and discipline the army. The troops loved him. He got the army in shape. But then the next phase of leadership that McClellan was required to show was aggressiveness in tactics, taking that army into battle. And he would always complain that the Confederates had more troops than he did, more supplies, so he would hold back until finally he'd get attacked. Battles would be lost. And finally, Lincoln realized this beautiful army that McClellan had created was, as Lincoln said, a stationary army. It just wasn't moving. So he kept writing McClellan, "You've got to take them into battle. I'm telling you this for your own good." And finally, when McClellan still wasn't listening, Lincoln made a pledge to himself to counter this own weakness on his part, to give him too many chances. "If he does not move this army by a particular date and time, then I'm making a pledge to myself and my maker that I will fire him." He did not move by that date. He fired him. And then, of course, after a few more bad generals, he finally got General Grant. And then when he was angry, he had a great ritual that he would follow. Instead of ever dressing the person down in person, or at least most of the times he rarely did, he would write what he called a hot letter against the person, where all of his emotions would come out. And then he'd put the letter aside, hoping that he would never need to send it. The most dramatic moment of that is when General Meade failed to follow up with General Lee's army after the victory at Gettysburg. He wrote Meade a long letter because he was so upset about this happening, in which he said, you know, he was immeasurably distressed. Had Meade followed up with Lee's army, the war might have come to an earlier end, but now it was going to go on month after month, year after year. But then knowing how much it would hurt Meade, he put the letter aside, his emotions cooled down. The letter was never even discovered until years later when his papers were opened in the next century, and at the bottom was a notation by Lincoln, "Never sent and never signed." He also understood what I think all leaders have to understand, which is how to relax and replenish his energies to face the struggles of the following day. One of the things that he did 100 times during his years as president was to go to the theater. He said when he went to the theater and a Shakespeare play would come on and the darkness would descend on the theater, he could imagine himself back in Prince Hal's time and for a few precious hours forget the pressures of the war. There was also a great sense of, I think all leaders have had to figure out how to relax. Franklin Roosevelt had the most amazing thing that he did during World War II. He would have a cocktail hour every night during the war, and the rule was, and all of his great friends would be there, the rule was that you could not talk about the war. You couldn't even talk about politics. You could discuss books you'd read, movies you'd gone to see. You could gossip about who was involved with whom, as long as for a few hours he could not have to think about the war. And to make this cocktail hour work, he liked to have his closest friends actually living with him in the White House so they'd be close by. So the White House actually became the most exclusive residential hotel during World War II. His foreign policy advisor and good friend Harry Hopkins came for dinner one night early in the war, slept over, didn't leave until the war came to an end. His secretary, Missy LeHand, who loved him from the time she was 18, lived with the family in the White House. Princess Martha from Norway, in exile in America during the war, lived with the family on the weekends. Lorena Hickok, a former journalist who loved Eleanor, had a bedroom next to Eleanor. And most importantly, Winston Churchill came and spent weeks at a time at the White House in a bedroom diagonally across from Roosevelt's. They would stay up together until 2 a.m., talking, drinking, smoking, until finally Eleanor would come in and say, "Isn't it time for you two boys to go to bed?" In fact, Churchill's visit there right after Pearl Harbor is one of my favorite stories in World War II. But before I get to that, what I'll say is I was always obsessed with the idea of what it must have been like when these great people in the Roosevelt White House were relaxing at night in their bathrobes as they gathered on the second floor corridor that surrounds the bedroom suites up there on the White House, and wishing that when I've been up there with Lyndon Johnson, I thought of asking, where did Churchill sleep? Where was Roosevelt? Where was Eleanor? But of course, I wasn't thinking in those terms then. So I happened to mention this on a radio program when I was in Washington when the Roosevelt book came out, and it happened that Hillary Clinton, who was then First Lady, was listening. So she promptly called me up at the radio station, inviting me to sleep overnight in the White House. She said we could then wander the corridor together and figure out where everyone had slept 50 years earlier. So 2 weeks later, she followed up with an invitation to a state dinner, after which, between midnight and 2 a.m., the President, Mrs. Clinton, my husband, and I, with my map in hand, went through every room up there and said, yes, Chelsea Clinton is sleeping where Harry Hopkins once slept. Bill Clinton is sleeping where FDR was. And we were sleeping that night in Winston Churchill's bedroom, which meant there was no way I could sleep. I was certain he was sitting in the corner drinking his brandy and smoking his cigar. In fact, that bedroom is the scene of one of my favorite stories in World War II, which is that one that Harry Hopkins told, which is that when Churchill was there, he and Roosevelt were set to sign a document that put the Allied nations against the Axis powers, but the Allied nations were calling themselves then the Associated Nations, and no one liked the word. So early that morning, Roosevelt awakened with the whole new idea of calling them the United Nations. It's where the word presumably was born. He had himself wheeled into Churchill's bedroom to tell him the news, but as the story was told, Churchill was just coming out of the bathtub and had absolutely nothing on. So Roosevelt said, "I'm so sorry, I'll come back in a few moments." But Churchill, ever able to speak spontaneously in a very formal voice, said, "Oh no, please stay. The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." Can you imagine? I mean, you're dripping from the tub. His stomach is sticking out, and he has the presence of mind to say that. Then, when he hears the word United Nations, he has the further presence of mind, Churchill does, to quote an entire poem in British literature where the words United Nations had once been used. So that night, I couldn't wait to get in the bathtub. Then I truly felt I was in the presence of the greatness of the past. So at any rate, these presidents all have to find a way to somehow relax and replenish their energies. And in Lincoln's case, perhaps the most important resource he had was humor. He was a great storyteller. From the time he was young, when he was on the circuit in Illinois, and the lawyers used to travel together from one village courthouse to the other, when it was known that Lincoln was in town, people would come from miles around to listen to him tell stories. He could tell stories for hours on end, entertaining the crowd. And almost like in his brain, he could remember those stories during the Civil War, and when something reminded him of them, he could pull it out right before a tense cabinet meeting. And the stories are not quite what you might expect from our marble monument. One of his favorite stories had to do with the Revolutionary War hero, Ethan Allen, who came here to England after the Revolutionary War. And the British were still upset about losing the war, so they decided to embarrass him a little bit by putting a huge picture of General Washington in the outhouse where he would have to encounter it, the only outhouse around where they were. And they figured he'd be upset about the indignity of George Washington being in an outhouse. But he went into the outhouse, and he came out not upset at all. And they said, well, didn't you see George Washington there? Oh, yes, he said. I think it was the perfectly appropriate place for him. What do you mean, they said? Well, he said, there's nothing to make an Englishman shit faster than the sight of General George Washington. So you can imagine, if you tell a story like that and the cabinet is in the middle of a tense cabinet meeting, things are going to have to lighten up somewhat. The pressures seemed almost impossible to imagine for Lincoln. He later said that if he had ever known how difficult it would be between his inauguration and the decision to send supplies to Fort Sumter in April, that he couldn't have lived through it, but of course he did. He possessed a remarkable ability, it seemed to me, which all leaders have to have, to bounce back from invariably setbacks that are invariably going to happen, to shake off his anxiety. The minute he heard that a battle had been lost, and in the early days they were lost frequently for the Unions, his immediate instinct was to go to the battlefront. He would take a train or a ship or a car, a horse-drawn car, and get right to the soldiers so that he could walk amidst the thinning ranks, visit the wounded in the hospital, tell stories to the soldiers that they could then tell to countless others. Somehow, by bolstering their morale, he was able to bolster his own morale, and then come back and give strength through his own profound convictions to the North that this war, as difficult as it might seem at that moment, would eventually be won. He seemed to have a profound connection to the people in the North. And I think it came in part because he opened his White House considerably in a way that it would be impossible for us to do today. In the days before the Civil Service Commission, before security wraps the White House as it does today, if you wanted a job, you could simply line up in front of Lincoln's office inside the White House and wait and tell him your particular story, why you needed a job as a postmaster or a clerk given your family situation. Lincoln's secretaries, Nicolay and Hay, would despair. Lincoln, you don't have time for these ordinary people, as he would spend hour after hour with them. He said, you're wrong. These are my public opinion baths. I must never forget the popular assemblage from which I have come. And then he had these huge White House receptions where everybody could come. Diplomats and backwoodsmen would be seated side by side, and he would shake everybody's hand. The most dramatic moment of that, on January 1st, 1863, he was set to sign the Emancipation Proclamation later that afternoon, but that morning at the New Year's reception, he had shaken 5,000 hands. So when he went to sign the proclamation, his own hand was so numb and shaking that he had to put the pen down. He said, if ever my soul were in an act, it is in this act. And yet if I sign with a shaking hand, posterity will say he hesitated. So he waited until his hand could come back to full form and sign with a bold and clear hand. And not long after that, his old friend Joshua Speed came back to the White House, and pointing to the Emancipation Proclamation, he said to Speed, maybe in this document my fondest wish to be remembered will indeed be realized. Perhaps that feeling that he had of understanding the currents and the mood of the country is what contributed to his ability to know when to speak to the nation, when to issue a public letter. All leaders have to become masters of timing. And in his case, he understood, for example, at the time of the Gettysburg Address, that the battles had reached almost every home in the North, that the numbers of people dead were climbing and climbing, that people needed to have an even deeper conviction as to why the North was fighting the war, even beyond saving the Union, even beyond emancipating the slaves. And at that beautiful speech is where he enunciated that what they were really fighting for was something larger than either of those two goals. It was actually to save the democratic system that the Founding Fathers had created, the idea that ordinary people could govern themselves. Because if the South could secede from the Union, someday the West might secede from the East, and the idea that America was a beacon of hope to the world at large would be undone forever. But, of course, he put it in far more beautiful language than that, saying, we here highly resolve that the dead shall not have died in vain, that government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth. And then at the time of his second inaugural, just weeks before he died, when he could have done a triumphal message, the North is finally on the eve of winning that Civil War after such a long period of time, but instead he knows his next task of leadership is reconciliation. So the theme of the inaugural is that the sin of slavery was shared by both sides, Both sides, he said, read the same Bible. Both prayed to the same God. Neither's prayers were fully answered. And then the words we remember, with malice toward none and charity for all, let us bind up the nation's wounds. Less than 6 weeks later, his life would come to an end. On that last afternoon of his life, he went on a carriage ride with his wife, Mary. They'd had a very tumultuous time during the Civil War period, in part because she could never find her footing as First Lady. Though I'm convinced when they were first married, they were well suited for one another. She loved politics. She loved poetry. She could recite long passages from Shakespeare, as could he. She stood by him during all those early failed years, believing in his destiny. But once they got to the White House, he, of course, didn't have time for her as his partner, as he had before. Because she had four half-brothers who were in the Confederate Army, the Northerners looked at her. She came from Kentucky. The Northerners looked at her as if she were a traitor. The Eastern establishment looked down on her because she came from frontier Illinois. So she decided to create her reputation by redecorating the White House, a worthy ambition perhaps at another time, but in that day and age, when the soldiers didn't have enough blankets, it was considered a frivolous enterprise. And then when their 10-year-old son Willie died in February of 1862, she never fully recovered. There were four boys in the family. The oldest was at Harvard. Another had died at age 3 years before. Willie at 10 and Tad at 8 were the life of the White House. When Willie died, it seemed like Mary's life force was spent. And then Lincoln had to become both mother and father to that youngest child, Tad. But on that last afternoon of his life, they went on a carriage ride. And he told Mary they'd been so unhappy for so long between the war and Willie's death. But now the war was coming to an end, and time had proved some solace for Willie, that they had to try to find some happiness again. And they began to talk about where they might go once the presidency was over. She wanted to go to Europe. He wanted to go to California. They both wanted to go to the Holy Land. It made me sad to think that maybe they could have recaptured some of the spark of their earlier days. But, of course, it was not to be. I had not fully realized the extent of the plot that John Wilkes Booth had planned for that evening, because not only was he planning to kill Lincoln, but he had two co-assassins. One was designing to kill the Vice President, Andrew Johnson, and the third was to kill Seward, the Secretary of State, the next in line to the presidency after the Vice Presidency, with the hope that maybe if the top part of the government could be lopped off, then the South would have its final moment in the sun. The man who was assigned to kill Andrew Johnson had worked out a scheme where he knew the hotel where Johnson was staying, was going to be bringing a message to him, just kill him point blank. But luckily for Andrew Johnson, he went to the bar ahead of time, had much too much to drink, lost his courage, and ran away. But the man who was to kill Seward left a bloody massacre in Seward's house. As always, Seward's house was full of people, as typically it would be. Seward was in his bed at the time because he'd been in a carriage accident the week before and had broken his jaw. So the assassin came in pretending to be bringing medicine for Seward, somehow got to the top of the second landing outside the bedroom where he encountered Seward's son, who said his father was sleeping. He could not go in. He took the blunt edge of his revolver, hit the son with such force that his brain was exposed and he fell into a coma. He then ran into the bedroom with a huge Bowie knife, slashed Seward's other son, slashed the soldier nurse taking care of Seward, went to Seward's bedside, slashed his face with such force that his entire cheek was torn off. He lost a lot of blood. He was scarred for life. But because of the way the jaw was wired, he missed the jugular vein, and Seward did eventually recover. Not so, of course, for Lincoln. When Wilkes Booth came to the back of the presidential box and shot him in the back of the head, the wound was so devastating, the doctor said, that he should have died instantly. But he struggled for life until 7:22 a.m. the following morning, when Stanton, his war secretary, uttered the words that have come down through the generations, "Now he belongs to the ages." So that dream of Lincoln's to be remembered had surely been realized, but even he couldn't have imagined how far his reputation would reach. I was thrilled to find an interview in a New York newspaper in 1908 by Leo Tolstoy, the great Russian writer, which showed the breadth of Lincoln's reputation even then. Tolstoy told a remarkable story of a trip that he had recently made to a remote area of the Caucasus, where there were a group of wild barbarians who had never left this part of Russia. And knowing Tolstoy was in their midst, they asked him to tell stories of the great men of history. So he said he told them about Alexander the Great and Napoleon and Caesar and Frederick the Great. And they loved it, he said. But before he finished, the chief stood up and he said, "But wait, you haven't told us about that greatest ruler of them all. We want to hear about that man who spoke with the voice of thunder, who laughed like the sunrise, who came from that place called America, which is so far from here that if a young man should travel there, he would be an old man when he arrived. Tell us of that man. Tell us of Abraham Lincoln. Tolstoy was stunned, but he told him everything he could about Lincoln's childhood, his failures, his political career, the Emancipation Proclamation. And then in the interview, he said, now why was Lincoln so great? Not as great a general as Napoleon, not as great a statesman as Frederick the Great. But he concluded, and I think historians would roundly agree, his greatness consisted in the integrity of his character and the moral fiber of his being. So that dream that had powered Lincoln all through that bleak childhood to be remembered, that dream that had carried him through his laborious efforts to educate himself and through the darkest days of the war, had been realized. His story would be told after he died. Now, for most of us, the chance to have our story told after we die will not be realized through marble monuments in Washington, but rather through the memories of our children, our families, our professional colleagues, and our friends. Which brings me back at the end to where my own love of history really began, to the days when I was only 6 years old and my father taught me that mysterious art of keeping score while listening to baseball games, so that when he went to work during the day, I could record for him the history of that afternoon's Brooklyn Dodger game. Now, when you're only 6 years old and your father comes home every single night, and I now realize that I, in excruciating detail, recounted every single play of every inning of the game that had just taken place that afternoon, but he made me feel I was telling him a fabulous piece of history. It makes you think there's something magic about history, which is where my love of it really began. And though my father died when I was still in my 20s, before I had my three sons, I have passed his memory as well as his love of baseball onto my boys, though when I moved to Boston, I became an irrational Red Sox fan as opposed to an old Brooklyn Dodger fan. And even now, I must say, when I sit with our season tickets at Fenway Park, I can sometimes close my eyes against the sun and imagine myself a young girl once more in the presence of my father, watching the players of my youth on the grassy fields below, Jackie Robinson, Roy Campanella, Pee Wee Reese, Duke Snider. I must say there is magic in these moments, for when I open my eyes and I see my sons in the place where my father once sat, I feel an almost invisible loyalty and love linking my sons to the grandfather whose face they never had a chance to see, but whose heart and soul they have come to know through all the stories I have told. Which is why, in the end, I shall always be grateful for this love of history, allowing me to spend a lifetime looking back into the past, allowing me to believe that the private people we have loved and lost in our families, and the public figures we have respected in our history, just as Abraham Lincoln wanted to believe, really can live on, so long as we pledge to tell and to retell the stories of their lives. Thank you for letting me do that with you tonight. Thank you.